It's the last book I'm going to write for a bit about inequality, because there's a limit. 10 was too many. What happened is people carried on asking, and the thing went from something we hardly talked about at all 15 years ago. With the spirit level, it has to be said, that book was absolutely incredible. And with the attacks on the spirit level, which, although they were nasty and stupid, I think actually helped keep the publicity going. I've called it a peak because there are lots and lots of signs that we may be at the peak. A peak is not necessarily great. The last peak was 1913. So what happens after a peak isn't necessarily brilliant. Don't worry, in the next 30 minutes there'll be enough misery for people who like misery. But I'm going to err towards the optimistic side of things. That graph there is from a little book called Do We Need Economic Inequality? It's from other people's data. Data going back a long way is very hard to find, but you'll see there in 1725 the United Provinces were at their kind of peak inequality. House prices in Amsterdam, after they reached their peak in Amsterdam, fell in real terms for 250 years. So you should remember that. A country at the height of its inequality and power, they can fall. You can see how equitable the 13 American colonies were. If you've got amazingly good eyesight, you have to get the book to be able to see these graphs. That's the trick. And you can see that time of great equality after the Second World War and where we are now. But of course, the Netherlands chose not to be like that. The Netherlands were just down there. Over time, over the long cycle of history, inequality goes up and down and up and down. But I haven't got enough time to go on about that. This graph isn't in the book. I thought I should mention wealth. Wealth trends tend to lag income trends by about 10 years. Peter Townsend did some of the best work on wealth inequalities in the past. And he had wealth inequalities still falling even after income inequalities had started to rise in the 1980s, because there's a lag. Wealth is the stock of money, it's what you've got. Income is the flow, it's how much you get in a year. All these little things coming down are the wealth of people in housing by age falling from 2008 to 2012. Not a declining wealth inequality yet, because the young have no housing wealth and can't get a house at all. So in fact, the wealth inequality widens even as the houses actually fell in value. But don't think that wealth inequality will rise forever. All inequalities eventually come down. Unless we're heading for a Blade Runner society. And they have in the past. I'm an optimist. I'm constantly looking for signs of turns. The Chancellor, in his budget, Philip Hammond, said that inequalities have been falling since 1990. This is a brilliant lie the Tories love to do. It's an ONS figure. It's actually an ONS statistic. And it's the ratio of the median of the top quintile to the median of the bottom quintile. Mm-hmm. And that did peak in 1990. The median of the top quintile completely ignores the best off 10th of people. And the median of the bottom quintile completely ignores the bottom 10th of people. And Philip Hammond is either too stupid to realise that matters, which is possible. Which is possible. He's devious enough to make £9 million out of care homes, but that is easier than understanding means and medians. Mm-hmm. Or Philip is actually clever than I give him credit for, and he's a devious and nasty man. He doesn't mind lying to people. And I don't know which of those two things is true. I don't think there's a third. The first thing, go for that. So, what you had happened since 1990 is that inequalities fell for people in the middle. It was only later that they fell for some people at the bottom of the top 10%. For the 1%, they didn't begin to fall for people at the bottom of the 1% until about 2015. But around about 2016, 2017, we saw our first reported fall in my lifetime of chief executive officers' pay. If you like, they're not bankers, but that figure of the banker, he was getting 146 times an average wage in 2015. That dropped to 128 times in 2016. It was an average drop of a million. in the income of CEOs. The drop was bigger for men than for women. It was bigger for the higher paid CEOs than lower. It actually was greater equality among CEOs. I know you're not here because you're too bothered about CEOs. And the reporting was very good. The reporting was, it's still too high. No celebration of the first drop in my lifetime of top pay. The latest figures this year show going back up again, but only to 145 times the median. Now, this is a sliver of hope, but it is still a fraction below the peak, and that's the top pay. There are two ways in which inequality falls, in which equality rises. One is fast and the other is slow. This is the fast way. This is the take of the top 1% in Germany and Japan. You know things are getting very bad when the top 1% begin to take more and more. The triangle's going up in Germany. Japan was an aristocratic feudal society right through to the start of the Second World War, very, very unequal. Losing a war. You lose a war, you get rid of your elite. I've never seen an example in history where getting rid of the elite has not been advantageous. Interestingly, the elite always becomes corrupt. You get rid of the elite, you get rid of the power. In the case of Japan, which comes right down to here, the Americans are so partly embarrassed about what they did, not just the atomic bombs, but also the incredible rate of abortions that then the Japanese population, never seen a rate of abortion like it since, far more than 6 million. But also they're worried about the communist revolution in Japan. And Americans redistributed the land and the wealth as evenly as they could amongst the Japanese population in the world's best and largest ever experiment in what happens if you make people more equal. And the answer is you get one of the most successful economic societies in the world, and you have one where life expectancy quickly rises to be the highest on earth, and infant mortality is the lowest. And I can go on and on about the advantages of Japan. But Germany's not bad either. Little rise recently. Here's a slow way. The slow way is the Netherlands. About 250 years after you've been top dog in the world, you can kind of work out how to be normal. Sadly, it takes a couple of centuries and a half. But there's the Netherlands getting itself down year by year. People get angst by this. We'll talk about very recent in a minute. And here's Switzerland. Okay, it's not down, but they've kept a lid on it. The Swiss 1% take half what our 1% take. If you took half of the wealth of the Sunday Times Rich List, they'd still be incredibly rich. But we could do, you could forget worrying about having to cost a manifesto if you just said we're going to have half of the wealth of the Sunday Times Rich List. The bit you'd take is their property, because they can't take that offshore. I'm more for the slow way of doing these things than the fast. But just to point out, inequality falling is a very normal thing. It happens just as often as inequality rising. It has to. Next three slides are very boring, but just in case you don't believe me, in most countries of the world, this is certainly true for most poor countries, but I'm only going to show you for rich countries, inequality is past the peak. This is the OECD Gini measure, the most accepted measure of inequality. We've only got one figure for Australia. Austria, the peak was 2013. Belgium, peaking still now, you can read through it. But you've got more countries that have gone past the peak. It's knife edge. But they're not all still zooming up. And some of them are still waiting for 2016-2017 data. Greece peaked in 2013. Less inequality 2014, less in 2015. The rich lost more than the poor when things fell apart. The rich had a lot more to lose. But this is what a peak looks like. It is not certain, but it is not things still going up. And the only way you know is by measuring the thing. So not just talking about the UK, talking about most of the world appears to be going past. They're in alphabetical order. Scandinavian countries being slightly disappointing. they are incredibly equal. You know, the happiest, apart from Japan, longest lived countries and so on. But a tiny little rise going on there for Norway. Still very, very equal. But the key message is that those blue boxes are over there, the more recent figures that we're getting. Many years after the financial crash, are lower, okay? And here's the one that includes us. And we had a higher Gini in 2015. It's been lower since 2016. There are lots of reasons, apart from the CEOs, to believe it'll go lower still. There's a wonderful agency in Canary Wharf called the European Banking Authority that requires every bank in Britain to report on the salaries and all the secret salary deals of every banker. We have something like 2,700 bankers paid over €1 million a year, and that's all the perks kind of included, and they really try to sneak the money through in ways that you can't tell. Next highest is 197 in Germany. But there aren't these £1 million bankers anywhere else. They're all here in London. Their salaries have been falling now for over 2 years. Top London banker salaries. Not the top salaries, not they're falling even faster. I'll tell you about them in a minute. But the ones around about €1 million, and of course they're falling because the reason they gave for paying them was that if we don't pay them this much, they'll leave. Mm. Now that was a lie, because the only place they could go is New York, because that was the only place that paid bankers this much, and New York already had bankers, right? They couldn't go anywhere else in Europe. They couldn't go to Switzerland because Switzerland pays bankers half as much. But now, for the last 2 years, you're running banks in London, you've got to persuade people to go to Frankfurt and Paris and Dublin and all the other places that they're quietly going to, because they'd like to carry on existing when we're not passported. So of course you don't pay them more, because they're the grumpy ones who have refused to leave yet. We can go down for bankers, we can look at chief executives of the BBC, other prominent positions like that. Falling, vice chancellors of universities, my favourite group. Amazing, you suddenly charge £9,000 a year. And boom, all that money, so tempting, isn't it? Top vice chancellors of universities, the good ones, or the ones who've realised it's career ending, took 1% last year. Okay, still took a pay rise, 1%. The shame's beginning to happen. Back in the 1930s, 20 years after the previous inequality peak, there was a change in the moral sentiment. And the change in the moral sentiment was, it is wrong to be greedy and take more when there's so much trouble in the world. And we are at the change, potentially, in the moral sentiment now. You could lose it, it could reverse. It is the work of My Fair London, it's the Inequality Trust, it is advocates in America, it is a lot of shouting about a really complicated thing, which is a statistical measure of variance. People used to joke about university lecturers wanting to complain about rectify the anomaly, about their pay. You know, but having a campaign based on a measure of variance in statistics is amazing that you can get this far. Justin Welby, in the Financial Times, talking about his mates who he used to work with in the finance industry, when they said they used to get eight-figure, £10 million salaries, and now somebody that high up would be getting five. It's the changes at the top. Now, of course, there's cuts at the bottom. The problem at the bottom is a cut much smaller than £5,000, just a cut of £200, has significant effects on your life. People sometimes ask me in Oxford, I blame the university for why our school at the bottom of the league table does worse. The university colleges don't like paying the Oxford Living Wage. If you pay the Oxford Living Wage to a cleaner rather than the minimum wage they currently pay, that cleaner will get an extra £500 a year. That £500 is enough to buy a second-hand computer. Second-hand computer is what you need if your child is doing GCSEs. It is the University of Oxford that is primarily responsible for the low GCSE results of the school at the bottom of the league table in my city. You know, what may appear the amount of money that you're going to try to raise with the bucket at the end of this to pay for this room alters you from getting a B to a D later on. Seamus Healy poem for my friend Mary O'Hare. Mary O'Hara has a whole project based in the States about getting people to think about inequality. History says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then once in a lifetime the longed for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. These things only happen occasionally, these peaks. What's really interesting about economic inequalities and income inequalities is that they don't go like this. They go from the 1913 peak, in the case of the US about 20 years later, all the way down to the 1970s. And they begin to rise about 1977, before 79, and then they just go up and up and up. And you cannot see the effects of any election on them. Didn't matter. What happens politically is that all the political parties move to the left when inequality falls, and all the political parties move to the right when it rises. So what you've got to decide is whether in the last 2 years you think the Conservative Party has actually moved to the left. When George Osborne began taxing landlords more, which you may not have heard of because they've got nowhere to go, when they took the cap off borrowing for local authorities last week, there were other things. As you can probably tell, I don't like the Conservatives. But it's when the Conservatives start to move to the left, you know you've really won. We probably won't have a debate about whether Labour's moved to the left. That picture's from 1914, I think. They're Harrow boys. You can tell a Harrow boy if you ever need to tell a Harrow boy. Winston Churchill, we're an amazing country. I was outside Parliament, and there's that Harrow boy with his cane and his hat. They have canes and hats. There they are cheering on their cricket team at the annual Eton Harrow match in London. There were their mums beneath them with a bit of hair. There's Dad, who also went to Harrow, at the bottom of the photo. They've got no idea what's about to happen. They're at the top of the universe. These are the richest people the planet has ever known. At the centre of the largest empire and the most successful empire ever. And a small war starts in Europe that's supposed to be over in 2 months. And then many of them are dead. Here's a couple of graphs. I'm guessing you're fairly aware of this, but in case you're not, this is the 1%, this is the 10%. The 10% are now back up to taking about 40% of everything, leaves everybody else who's 60%. I've got 10 minutes left and too much to show you, and it probably bores you if you don't get this. Much more unequal in the past. Most common job for women is being a servant. Those young men didn't ever make their own bed. Go down to here when I was a child. This was unbelievable equality. That is what I, and quite a lot of you, saw. It wasn't a dream. You weren't high. It's not rose-tinted glasses. It was good. Real salaries for working people were twice as high. You didn't worry about what school you went to. You didn't know what the good or the bad school was. We just got comprehensives at this point. You could get a house. You could get a house when you're 21 or 22. You could have kids and a family, and you could go on holiday, camping. Oh, 1970s, bloody brilliant. Absolutely, best decade ever. Not perfect, but honestly. Full employment still, till the end. You could tell your boss, and if they did anything wrong, I'd just go and get another job. Right? That's what a good society is like. And then we did this. We can debate about why we did it, and nowhere else in Europe did this quite as badly. We were at 15.1%. It's gone down. So I'm trying to say that that's the peak, and we're on the edge of it. Doesn't have to be. Hard Brexit, Empire 2.0. I can go through a scenario, let in the billionaires, take the tax rate right down to 5%. You know, get rid of what's left of the state very, very quickly. Short of bringing in tanks, how are you going to make people accept that? Same boys, well, not the same boys, but they look the same when they have to have the cane and the hat. Most famous social science photo, 1937, Harrow-Eton cricket match. Not so sure of themselves. Bit wary. Working class boys looking a bit cocky at them. So that photograph is famous because it's about a change in time. It captured halfway towards that kind of equality in the 70s that we got. The children of those three boys would live in the most equal times these islands have ever known in human history. You know, possibly more equal than the hunter-gatherers had. Possibly. Silly arguments. Very sadly, those two boys, one was dead shortly after a fever that he got by going to the colonial place his parents sent him, and the other one was in a mental institution and then died shortly after. Just coincidence, not common outcome. If you want the date for the actual day of the peak, it is the point at which Martin Sorrell resigned, or was helped to resign, the highest paid man in Britain. Least happy man, I think. There's lovely research on the effects of flying in private jets on your skin and why you shouldn't envy people who have their own aeroplanes. Anyway, sorry. I won't say any more. Maybe he'll sue me. Maybe he won't. If having lots of money made people really happy, it would be harder. Peaks, other peaks. These are swings as conventionally measured the general election since 1945. You'll know about the 1945 landslide. We'll go all the way through to... That's the 1997 landslide. That was the end of 18 years of Conservative rule. People were voting to get rid of that, and for a young man who wore cufflinks and smiled and looked pleasant, called Tony Blair. Okay? This is Tony Blair without 18 years of Conservative rule. He lost votes in the next general election. He then managed to lose even more votes in 2005. His friend Gordon Brown, having finally been allowed to stand after a broken promise or two, takes over but has to face an election after the greatest financial crash. And Gordon manages to get a minus 6% swing. Lovely little sweet Ed Miliband agrees to bite a sandwich with bacon in it, or anything. And this is incredible. 1.4% swing. In the context of this, is incredible. Ed got a 1.4% swing. Absolutely brilliant. Should get a knighthood for it if he'd ever accept one. Right? Because it is hard. And then this. 9.6%. Right? Very happy to argue with about it, but, you know, that's big. It's there. It's never going to go away. Written in history. Okay? Things change. This graph here is the segregation index of Conservative voters. In the past, Conservative voters were very segregated, didn't live with other people. When we became much more equal, you had Tories everywhere, Labour everywhere. Segregation increases all the way from 1974, October, through to 2015, and then segregation falls. So Labour picked up more votes in June 2017 in areas that were not traditionally Labour. And that curve in the geography of politics fits the inequality curve. Gonna zip through, the book has seven sections. I've only got one slide per section. Say, I'm lying, the last one's got five, but apart from the last section, one slide. Housing, this is the map of the falls in house prices in August 2016, according to Zoopla. House prices began to fall then, mainly in London. Last week I took a picture of an estate agent's window on Cowley Centre in Oxford, which had 10,000 off some, 20,000 off other houses. Never have houses fallen in price in the city of Oxford. It is happening. The interesting question is where and when will it stop? That little block of the very rich, what keeps the wealth there is the idea that your property is safe. Nobody's going to take your £8 million mansion off you or land value tax it. Well, there's somebody who might. Right? Oh, the last time, by the way, okay, I've just talked about two political parties. The third largest political party in Westminster is the Scottish National Party. The last time the third largest party were nationalist was 1918, when it was Sinn Féin. Right? You know things are, you know, odd when that happens. Worldwide, because I'm obsessed by Britain, so not much. There are things that don't peak. This graph here you can't see, again you have to get the book. This is the average age at which mums have kids. First kid. No sign of it slowing down at all, not one. Of course it's going to have to, you know, because the menopause exists. And the human, you know, we're not going to be children of men with nobody having a baby. But just to tell you, there are, I look at lots of data, and that's the best thing of something that hasn't hit a peak. Why does that graph do that? Because you have all those servants in the past and you can't have a baby if you're in the attic. Because you don't pay a maid to cause that noise when she's going to clean your house. Get rid of the servants, become more free, you get down to an average age in the 20s of having kids in those wonderful 1970s. Who does check out? Is there anybody who had a child in their 20s in the 1970s here? We've got, no, you're too young. Oh, well done, thank you. Admit, you lucky people. And because if you did, of course, you had children at the age when you're young and healthy and you could actually deal with the sleep deprivation. Whereas these poor suckers at the end here, having babies in their 30s, and if you're middle class, late 30s, it's a form of torture. This thing here is the acceleration in the slowdown of population worldwide. So we're now heading more towards 9 billion than 10. There are lots and lots of good news stories worldwide. We're heading to the first stabilisation of human beings in the planet's history. You know, and yes, we're heading to 1.5 to 2 degrees, you know, see on the heat, but lots of good ones. There's more and more evidence about how terrible inequality is. This is the relationship between average mathematics scores at age, around about up to age 24. One problem is people are made stupid in unequal countries, which is partly how you can get the inequality to grow. Student debt, this is an American graphic. Unequal countries have massive student debts and loans. Most of Europe, no fees, almost no fees. How many of you knew that you can go and study in Germany for free? Good.
You can study in Scotland for free.
Not if you're English.
No, of course not.
No. But if you're English, you can still go, and even after Brexit, unless something, because Germany takes people in for their entire world study for free, wait for it, they take in 330,000, which is more than we have overseas students. You go, how can they do that? It's not that hard. There's loads and loads of unhealth in the book because health is dramatically bad. This is data from ONS. Our life expectancy peaked in 2014. It's been falling since. This is the mortality rate, age 6 standardised. This began about 2012. They said it was flu. 2013 they said it was flu. 2014 they said it was flu. Loads of deaths in 2015. 50,000 said it was flu. They finally stopped saying it's flu because I started swearing. I think, and not just me, lots of people. And naming the individual officers and the 24 press officers in the Department of Health. And begin to wonder whether they're personally culpable for deaths if they help to pretend it's flu. That cannot carry on. This will change. Right? We won't have hit peak life expectancy in 2014, but it's that bad. Infant mortality rose in the last 2 years, significantly, the only place in Europe where it's rising. Thursday last week, 5 of the 6 maternity units in Oxfordshire were closed at short notice. Short notice means a couple of hours. All home births were cancelled. If you were in Chipping Norton, you had to check Facebook to see when the Chipping Norton maternity unit would reopen, or whether you had to go into the JR to have your baby. And they didn't quite put, do not go into labour at 6 a.m. in the morning, because the roads into Oxford are traffic jams at 6:30. That's how you get infant mortality rising. And the deaths are in the first couple of days of life. Future, and I'm over by a minute, so I'll zip through the future. Again, you have to get the book. The picture on the cover is from a protest, these lovely protests, because they're very efficient. You know, just 12 people put on pig masks and get a lot of press. I think we need more of these. They were kind of quite fashionable a few years ago, they need to come back. Protests at the Lord Mayor's Banquet in 2011, 14th of November 2011, at the Lord Mayor's Banquet, a protest about inequality and greedy bankers, where David Cameron gave a speech in which he boasted he now had an opportunity to begin to refashion the EU so it better serves this nation's interests. So was David right or were the protesters right? There's a lot to predict. The last section of the book are things I wrote for an anarchist magazine about what might happen in the next 100 years. So, and it's fun things, but I'm out of time. But it is not that hard, I think, to be optimistic. It just depends on whether you think human beings are capable or not. What we don't know is whether we are very stupid apes, or whether collectively, in some way, we can do better. That's what we're trying to discover. This particular statue is of a man who was probably a paedophile, that Rhodesia's named after. He looks very upset, he's stepping out. I've suggested that if Theresa May cancels Article 50, we take him down, put him indoors, and have a statue of Mrs. May up there. Anyway, looking equally miserable.
Dancing.
Well, of course, yes, dancing would be good. You've got to think, how will our education system be different in future? We have the most divided education system in all of Europe. We segregate our kids in what is a form of apartheid. It's not unfair to use the word apartheid for how we do it. It's tragic. Unbelievably tragic that our children do not get to mix with each other. And then even the ones like him, you know, forced to work till 10 o'clock at night every day when he's 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, at a total cost of £250,000 to maximise the number of A stars he appears to get so he can get into the right college to get the second class degree when David got the first. housing. You can try to imagine how the housing inequality we currently have could get worse, but it's not easy because we've already gone beyond rent prices around hospitals that nurses can actually pay. So what's happening in London and in my hometown is people are coming and working for 6 months so they can put the name of the hospital on their CV, and they go after 6 months because mum and dad won't give them money for food anymore because the salary goes entirely on the rent. Ridiculous situation with housing in Britain. The last graph, I know it's complicated, but it is the last graph, so there won't be another graph. I hope that's true and I'm not lying. This is IMF data. The bottom line is the UK. It is the proportion of GDP spent on public services, which is almost the same as the amount you tax, give or take government borrowing. It was down at 35%. For a long time we've been a low spending, low tax country. Labour stuck to Tory spending plans for the first 2 years, thanks Tony Blair. Then we get that lovely little increase in public spending. Looks nice. I won't jump over, but the black line just started to rise. Sadly, that's the cost of the Iraq war. Anyway, so it goes up. Those rises for everybody is the bailing out of the banks. And we're currently heading to here, which is about 36-37%. Were there to be a shock election, were Labour to get elected and be in power, all power the SNP, and were you to enact the Labour manifesto, that moves from there to there. Right? That is what the spending plans in the Labour manifesto are, to go from there to there, just below Spain. If Macron gets his way in France, this goes from here to here. Within each country, you play a game about what is possible, which is completely understandable. You can't suddenly become the Netherlands, let alone Norway. But what's annoying is when people say, oh, that couldn't happen, it's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. And this is geography. You know, I'm a geography professor. This is geography. And you might say, oh, you know, Finland's a basket case because it's got falling homelessness, because it's got the best exam results in Europe, because the housing quality is high. Oh, of all the 20 countries of Europe and the USA, who's had the biggest increase in life expectancy in the last 6 years? It's Finland. Yes, who's had the worst in Europe? It's us. Since the spirit level was published, it's almost as if there were a God, and that God has decided to fix all the social statistics just to point out, to annoy the critics of it, that they were absolutely spot on. It is just uncanny. You know, most unequal country in the rich world, United States, back when they did the spirit level, what has the United States done? The second most unequal large country, UK, what have we done? What did somewhere like France do when it was offered the chance of voting in Le Pen? What did the French do? Did they vote for Le Pen? No, they got together and said, we're not going to do that. Silver lining is Brexit, I think. I happen to think 52-48 is perfect, so we might argue about that later. In hindsight, the Leavers were never going to go away. You'd have had to got 66% remain. 52-48 calls their bluff. You've got to try and do it. It is an absolute tragedy, but we're in the situation we're in because of that. If the Leavers had got more than 52, they'd be gung-ho. We'd already be Singapore. We'd have chucked out anybody with a passport that wasn't the right traditionally size and shape that we used to have. War and revolution in Russia and so on caused the peak to go down last time. Brexit compared to a war is better. And last slide. 2 years ago I wrote a piece about Jeremy Corbyn. And the piece about Jeremy Corbyn basically gave 10 reasons why he wasn't that bad. Well, you know, you might not think it was an absolute liability that he was the leader of the party and so on. And I naively sent it off to a website that I think was called Labour List, I don't know. And I didn't realise that they didn't like Corbyn. And they decided to title my piece, to take the piss, Why Corbyn's Moral Clarity Could Propel Him to Number 10, to show what a naive lefty professor I was. I never put that in the piece. That was a quote I had in the piece from somebody in New York. But it's interesting, isn't it, now, I think, that we're in a situation now, it doesn't necessarily have to be Jeremy, it's just the largest political party in Europe and it's moved, and it sees inequality as mattering. We're in a position where we're very close to very, very big changes happening very fast. When it really happens properly, all political parties move to the left and begin to compete with each other to be nicer. It's been such a long time since that happened that describing that, and you believe in me, is difficult. But there was a time when our political parties competed to build high quality standard houses for social rent. Right? And there was a time when the Tory party did an education act. Okay, they didn't quite do it right, but they were providing free secondary education for all. I'm going to shut up now. Sorry for overrunning slightly. And I promise to keep my questions, my answers short. Thank you.
Thank you, Danny. So I'm going to shout because I'm not by the microphone. So as I said, we've got about half an hour for questions, comments, discussion point, and that's very, that kind of optimism in a depressing context is quite an interesting kind of, we talk at work about cognitive dissonance, how to hold two different competing ideas in your head at the same time. That feels a bit like we're in this strange moment. But let me bring some questions. I see a lot of hands. Let me go to John there. Can I take three questions at once and then you can handle them? So there, and then there, and then here.
Thanks, Alex. Just first an observation, that's the front page of the Evening Standard, Class Envy, cashing in strike bosses 154,000 deal, which is obviously peanuts. That's just an observation. I picked it up as I was coming in, and it resonated with the huge disparity between that and what senior executive of banks are, and the damage the financial crash is still having on us. The question I want to ask is, I haven't read the book, but a lot of people are quoting him. Is it Walter Scheidel, the great leveller? And his argument, as I understand it, is that only with great violence has there been real changes in inequality. Yeah. So the two world wars, natural famine, plague, and you could argue, if you look at your Greece example, that's appalling austerity and internal devaluation, which is a savage way of equalising society. So I was wondering if you read the book and got any comments on his what he's putting forward.
So that's the kind of four horsemen of the apocalypse question. Let's take that.
Hi, thanks. So I might choose and ask two questions. First is technical yet social. I read something recently about share profit, the analysis, which I think the Bank of England still does, about how the distribution of profits differs between workers and owners, basically, between going to companies and profits rather than being sort of paid out. And I think they were saying that, it's decades and it's been shifting in favour of companies and away from what works for you. So just if you've got any comments on that and how that kind of fits in with this, I'll be interested. And then the other one was, I don't know if you've looked at all at the sort of social side of things and whether there's any correlation or not between changes in inequality and social morals. It's quite interesting how, even while inequality was increasing, the move towards social liberalism, including, by Tories, etc., has continued to increase.
Yeah. And last question, Liam.
Yeah, thank you, Danny. You mentioned in one of your slides the culpability of the press and also the way they twist it as they do. So, with the absolute paranoia that all the media have, probably The Guardian worse than the Mail or the Sun, really, if there is going to be a Corbyn for PM campaign, will not the press just kill it?
Okay, I'll do those four. First of all, Walter, he's wrong. He's right in that when you have very high inequality, things go wrong. You get more wars, you get disasters. The society falls apart with high inequality. But then he says it's the disaster that helped reduce the inequality. But it was actually what caused the disaster, and that was the stupid elite of Britain thinking we're going to play a game with Germany. When the war goes on for more than 2 months, you've got to find the money to pay for the war, you bring an inheritance tax, all kinds of things. So he's wrong over it isn't the event, it's what caused the event, which is the high rate of inequality. And he's secondly wrong because the Netherlands and a few other places show you can slowly and steadily bring it down without a disaster. On the share taken by workers and bosses, the FT did a lovely graph, might be a year ago, and it had all countries of Europe, and it had GDP change on one axis and wages change on the other, and the UK was alone in one box. So in Greece the GDP fell and the wages fell. The UK, our GDP had gone up, we'd actually got more money, but the wages were still reduced. So the bosses took, and this is alone, the only place in Europe, the bosses took all the extra profit they're making, and then they took a bit more. And then they're surprised that people were angry. Social mores and behaviour. One set is behaving decently to people, seeing other people as people, reduces under inequality. So if you spend time in a more equal country, you will see that people are concerned for other human beings and don't think it's a good idea if they are made to clean their own waste up and so on, and they don't bow down to people above as wonderful. The liberalism about homosexuality and so on is all about my mates. So it's you increase equality amongst people of the same income level as you. And because you'll have friends who are not white, and you might have some friends, even if you went to Eton, who are not men, and you have some friends who are gay, and you may be gay, then you worry about the inequalities that affect people on the same income, and you put your energy into that a lot more. But the fundamental inequality that alters people's lives, which is how much money you've got, that's, you can't touch that. Don't talk about it. You know, instead, let's worry about the pay gap between John Humphreys and the next highest paid member of the Today programme, which matters. But the key question is, couldn't you put the Today programme on with a set, imagine it, a set of young journalists, you know, around about 25 years old, paying them about £30,000 each? Do you think they might do a worse job?
No.
Or, you know, or a better job? And that brings us to the media. It's interesting because they've run out of things to say about him, haven't they? Mm-hmm. They've kind of trawled every last... The interesting thing about Corbyn, I mean, Corbyn has loads of faults. Really boring speaker. No good at soundbite, not Machiavellian. He's just better than every other possible MP would have been if you'd chosen any other at that point. He's the, you know, lowest expenses of everybody. Pretty boring home life. You know, there aren't many photos of him in an alley with anybody else. So, there's not much more they can say that they haven't tried already. What I wish the Labour Party had done, I'm not a party member, I wish they had chosen to go for the second deputy leader. I wish they'd said that the election will be around about the 29th of March, to put it off, and the second deputy leader will be a woman. That was the thing. And then, in effect, you elect Corbyn's successor now. A woman, preferably aged under 45, maybe not. There's 30 I can think of who could do it. And then whoever takes over from Corbyn, what's the press going to do? Are they going to say, you're even worse than Jeremy? You know, they begin to look silly. They will try. And they tried before. And that's what the Daily Mail did in the 1930s. And that's inequality. You can't be the most unequal country in Europe. There are a lot of countries in Europe. You can't be the most unequal country of Europe unless you've got everything going against you, including a very big press owned by some men with very weird ideas. Sorry, too long.
Okay.
Can we do two?
Two questions. I've got a question at the front here and a guy right at the back, and I'm going to come up here.
Danny, it's very entertaining, but I want to correct you on one thing. I was elected as a member of the European Parliament in 1994. The biggest percentage vote that Labour ever got was the 1994 European elections. I know it's not a Westminster election, when they got 47% of the vote and got 62 Labour MEPs. Yeah. They've got 12 currently. Secondly, I worked on Peter Townsend's poverty survey. It shows you how old I am. Back in the 1960s, I was one of his students. Peter had an answer to the question, what is to be done? And you remember the answer? He said, nobody should get more than 100,000 a year, and nobody should get less than 10,000 a year. And that was 1979. Now, you obviously have to upscale that to the current time. But actually, if you put that into politics, then that would be a really effective argument at election time. And the other question, of course, is Brexit. One of the reasons the capitalist press are so pro-Brexit now when they weren't in 1975, and that's the big difference, is because Europe are moving towards the regulation of wealth and offshore tax avoidance and all those things which are centred in London. Yeah. We are the tax avoidance capital of the world, us plus the Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands and all our other connections. So that's why they're so keen. And that's why Murdoch hates Europe, because we regulated to stop him dominating satellite television. Yeah. And now we want to take his money as well. So we have to connect it back to Europe and hopefully get the second vote as well.
Just a plug for My Fair London. So our manifesto in the last mayoral elections, we locked on 10 to 1 income multipliers as being absolutely reasonable for anyone and a maximum we should campaign for. Shout out.
Shout out.
Sorry.
More than my pre-economic question, but I'm hoping to hire Youngling next year. And so I read the McCarrick Council, and they had a very interesting number there. They're saying that people, kind of new managers nowadays, actually work more hours than service during the deal period. Now, I can't substantiate that, but I really did like the idea of that being quite a silly situation.
Yes.
So it's one of those things where, like, in your view, what is the value of having time as well as as well.
Yes.
Because I, for example, am by myself, but this is part of him now. I'd actually love to offer a lot of the training time, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
okay.
London
yeah.
must be less hard.
Yes.
So I'm kind of, what's with you?
How you do it? Okay, I'll do those two quickly. Thank you for all that. Just one thing on Labour getting the most votes in the European election 1994. I recently worked out how many votes the far right got at each European election since the first European election. And the last European election was 2014. If you define the far right as a party to the right of the mainstream European Conservative bloc, if you know, you know this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But so we're going to say you're far right if you're allied with the AFD and those Free Finns and the Swedish Democrats and all of that. Because the Conservative Party had left the main Europeans when about 2009 and were in a far right European bloc, by 2014, 51.9% of those who voted in European election, 51.9% in this country voted what somebody in Europe, mainland, would see as far right. We didn't realise. 51.9, you know, in hindsight, and we sent an even higher proportion of MEPs, the most disgusting set of MEPs. When the only good thing about Brexit, if you look at the MEPs that we're sending by region, this is the UKIP ones, there's loads of them, and the Tory ones. They are the core of European far-right edging on fascist politics from this country. And we send them. I mean, it's amazing what you can say in hindsight. it staggers me now that nobody spotted it. I didn't spot it. Because as everything moves to the right, you still think you're normal. Yeah. And as your Conservative Party becomes a nasty, hostile environment, semi-fascist, party, you're saying, oh, the Tories, they've always been nasty. No, it was a new kind of nasty. And as your Labour Party becomes, you know, ever more glad-handing and friendly with business and so on, you just go, oh, but still, they're better than the Tories. And you don't notice the shift.
Okay, thank you, Danny. Sean, and then, Sean.
Yeah, I was going to ask the Walter Schneidel question, and one of your answers was 200 years, the Netherlands. Is it 200 years for us, I suppose, is the question whereby we get there. And the reason that you were positing for a peaking and possibly a moving down, all I could get was moral sentiment, that the general public opinion was moving, I guess, against this sort of inequality. But we're still in a position where the crash didn't have an effect, it would appear, 10 years ago. We're still in a position where Labour and Tory are equal in the polls, with no significant gain. Is there not a question there that there's a polarisation there, that the whole country isn't moving, but that there's some sort of polarisation going on in the country between two different groups of people?
That's a good question.
I think you said that inequality has started to fall recently, and given that the Tories have been in power for 8 years and the impact of austerity on sort of low-income people and unemployed people, I was quite surprised to hear that. I wonder if you could explain a bit more. Maybe also could you say a bit more about what you think Brexit will say for Dane?
Well, okay, quickly on those two. The beginning of a fall in inequality isn't everything is suddenly great. You know, it is a very polarised country that doesn't know in what direction it's necessarily going. You've got to go back. The last time we saw a fall from a peak was 1913. Nobody realised it was. There was a young PhD student called Yul Dalton, who later became Chancellor of the Exchequer, who did the first measures of inequality at that time. But it doesn't... It's not suddenly a land of roses and flowers the minute it turns, but getting it to turn is difficult. Increasing it requires, making it worse, requires the European mainland to be stupid enough to allow our banks to carry on operating in Europe after a Brexit. the minute you've actually put a wall and you don't allow the passport in, then it's not just London that's in trouble, but we underwrite, partly through the Privy Council, the majority of the tax havens of the world. So potentially, through voting 52% leave, we could be destroying the tax havens. You know, what on earth are they thinking on Jersey and Guernsey right now? Jersey and Guernsey's advantage at the moment is that they are legally different. But if we are to leave, you might as well do your banking in Britain. What about the Isle of Man and then the Cayman Islands? So that's all out there. This is about income, but including income from benefits. And even the cuts to benefits that have happened, even the tax credits at the bottom for the income, have not been as great as the reductions in what pay is now given to people who come in at the top. It's very subtle. One way in which it happens is it's brilliant. And again, this is under the Tories. Last April, we had the first gender pay reporting, which if any of you work in an organisation that's got more than 250 people, how many of you saw that? You'll have seen the median pay of men and women by each quartile. What that means is that next April, you have to publish your next figures on gender pay gap in your organisation. This is an Academy Trust of Schools, a college in the University of Oxford, thousands of organisations. And you're sitting there and some man comes in and says, who's higher paid, says, I want a pay rise because I'm brilliant. And you know you've got to publish the figures next April. And that's one way in which it happens. Men won't be able to argue and haven't been able to argue their pay up the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, in a way they could in 2004, 2005 in the past. You know, I'm valuable, I'm talented, I'm going to fly off somewhere else if you don't give me an extra 50,000. That game, like Justin Welby was saying about his banker's friends quietly saying, I used to get 10 million a year and now I'm on 5 and I can't even complain about it. That's trickled. We notice all the bad examples, the head of an academy school getting £200,000, and we point it out. And that's your moral sentiment. You know, nobody says, oh, you should pay the head of an academy school £200,000 because it's a really tough job turning around the school and we need to reward the talent. The last time I saw somebody say that was yesterday night in St Peter's College Chapel, Oxford, when John Humphreys was being interviewed by the master of my college, and a student asked him about pay. And John Humphreys decided to go into a rant about how wonderful Graham Norton was and how nobody else could possibly do the things that Graham Norton does. And I thought, I haven't heard that argument for a long time. You know, so apart from John Humphreys, I don't hear anybody else talking about how top talent needs top pay anymore. That's a change in moral sentiment. It's got to carry on.
That question at the back, wasn't it?
Oh.
Leisure time.
Yeah. Very, very sorry, Faith. Yes. over the plus points. You don't get happier in more unequal countries. You work longer hours. You take more antidepressants. When you're asked a simple happiness question, are you happy? You go, yes, I'm great. You say, give me a number out of 10, you get 8 in the States. When you ask a few more questions, like do you sleep at night? Do you worry about the future? Those ones, you score bottom. It's just tragic. And it's a bit like what I was saying about flying around in private planes. You know, so you can get even more quickly to your next meeting. What kind of a life is it? What you need, what you want, is to be working, if you so wish, 25, 20 hours a week. Not 40, 48 or 50. To share the work around for people who want to do it. And so much work we do actually has negative effects. Advertising, getting people to buy things they don't want and don't need, so you can increase pollution and burn the planet up faster. And we spend twice as much on advertising in this country than in mainland Europe. In America, they spend twice as much than we do. You know, so there's loads of jobs we should stop doing. But there were nasty. The New Economics Foundation did a lovely league table of what is the most socially harmful job. And also which are the ones that are most beneficial. And the great news, this is a post-Brexit one, because whatever happens, even if we cancel Article 50, we're still in trouble. Right? Every scenario, we're in trouble. That's, you know, at least the only certainty I can give you is come April, May or June, I run through every scenario and it's going to be bad. Mm. Even the people's vote and you get it back, it's, you know, you're going to have a country half at civil war with having suffered Suez times 10 in terms of embarrassment. But the good news is, and we're going to be poorer and the pound will drop. We have more tourists to deal with. The great news is, on this socially useful jobs, the most socially useful jobs actually receive some of the lowest pay. So we can have people doing them, including, this is why I want this in 20 years' time, I'm being optimistic over 20, I'll be 70. I want the person who's dealing with my poor old ragged body in the last few years of life to actually be enjoying their job slightly, rather than having to deal with this grumpy old man and inserting his catheters as a kind of torture living in an unequal world. Because it will hurt. It will physically hurt having catheters inserted by somebody who hates their job. You know, I've got a selfish, personal, greedy reason to want a much more equal society, because growing old in an unequal society, even for a very affluent person, is a pretty miserable future.
Question here, and then Trevor.
Yeah, I'll try and be brief if I can actually form a sentence and speak. Yes, in terms of the UK and the structural inequality, Danny, you of all people would, I'm sure, be aware of the horror that is a universal career.
Yes.
I do think personally that it will be scrapped sooner or later, just as a matter of electoral survival. But the fact that it also is so, so pointedly political by design, that it targets the underemployed,
yes.
And it holds them responsible effectively for underemployment, but not their employers, with an S in brackets, as I often tell the DWP on Twitter.
I'll mention that. Do the other one and I'll come back to your tweets, which is brilliant.
Oh, thanks very much.
Go on.
About pay, because I take the point that Labour's policies would only take us to being Spain, but I didn't see any in their manifesto and all the things that they're putting out. I didn't see anything that actually raises pay. And it seems to me that pay, you know, you don't need to sort of be renationalising industries, they just need to put up the minimum wage to raise pay or increase the pay ratio. And I haven't seen anything on that front. And if I can just also raise the issue of assisted places. One of the things Labour did when they first came in was to abolish the assisted places scheme. And I still think that that was actually a mistake, and I think that's one of the drivers of inequality, is that people from lower incomes find it much harder to get into positions where they can challenge more elite jobs.
Okay, assisted places. First of all, on universal credit, your tweets are brilliant. But one thing you need to know is I only see half of them, because half the Twitter defamatory thing.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Which I boringly have turned on. So you clearly are using swear words. It shows how bad universal credit is. But the ones that get through are great. David Freud was the architect of this. Ian Douglas Smith was the patsy, who I don't think understood it. David Freud, does anyone know where he is now? Which Caribbean island he fled to? He's left. He's gone. He's left the country. And that's a massive news story. This man who worked for Blair. And then when the election happened, that didn't affect his job, he just switched party and carried on implementing this. We'll see what they do. You need something very, very different. But the situation we're going to be in, a lot wider proportion of the population are going to need some help, depending on what happens soon. It's unbelievable, because you ought to have been able to get, you know, not particularly nice, but a kind of merging of things, universal credit. It's not the hardest thing in the world. I know the civil servants in DWP might want to claim it is, but the idea of putting the benefits together and making sure there wasn't a cliff edge, so it wasn't worth not working, you know, and the fact they got it wrong is quite incredible. So this relates to your question. My preference is for a basic income. Or heading towards a basic income, mainly freedom of time, but also we need in future lots of people to sit around not doing very much. because we are an over-polluting country that consumes far too much, and we need to consume less. How do you get people to consume less? You get to a point where you can get a basic income. You won't be able to go on holiday or live the life of Riley, and you won't be able to buy lots of clothes, and it'll actually get our consumption down. This idea that we have to get people doing more and more and more is silly. Your question before you said about assisted places.
The question is, how do you get pay to rise? Other than
how do you get pay to rise? I wouldn't worry about getting pay to rise. I would get housing costs to fall, which is easier because everybody's got to pay housing costs. So you control private rents. You don't tell housing associations, councils, they've got to increase the rent. You get the cost, the actual value of housing down. A 1% fall in housing every year for 30 years to German levels is a doubling of pay in real terms. It's everybody benefits, and that's
build more social housing.
Yes, you can build more social housing, but don't charge it high. There's no need to charge high rents. The problem with assisted places for me is it co-opts people into a system where you're co-opted in to be with the people who are segregated from the rest. And it's just that it doesn't happen in other European countries, because the schools, Oxford is twinned with Bonn. All the schools in Bonn are state schools. German teachers find it hard to rank them. They can eventually tell you the Beethoven Academy, you know, is a bit posh than the other ones, but they're all fine, and they all do far better than any of our state schools. They have one big private school in Bonn, and it's for the extremely slow boys and the very rich. And it's embarrassing to have gone there. And their most famous pupil is Prince Philip. So kindly. And you don't want an assisted place at that kind of school. You want a system where your state schools are so good that nobody would want to be assisted.
You do, but we don't have that. It's obvious we don't have that.
No, but we can get that. You cannot sending a kid on the King's Scholarship to Eton creates somebody who writes a book with me. So my book last year, lovely man, he's not happy about the fact he went to Eton. You know, so my personal experience of people who've been on assisted places is it hasn't been a wonderful time for them. But
if people were in, so two meetings ago we had Professor Diane Ray came and spoke to us, who's written a brilliant book called Miseducation, which is a rich exploration of some of these problems, particularly the British education system, which I would really recommend to you if you want to read a bit more about how inequality in education in this country interact. Yeah. There were some more hands at the back there, so two together, yeah.
I wanted to come back to the conversation earlier about how moral outrage can play a role in reducing inequality, and the issue that mostly discussed was around high income earners and excessive wages and salaries. Given that that's not the only driver of inequality, I wondered if you might share a few thoughts on what you see being the other issues where we're starting to get moral outrage coalescing and where we might focus our energy as activists.
Okay.
And the question behind, yeah.
So my question is, if we assume that we are moving away from this inequality, what do you think is the likelihood and potential benefit of doing so in cooperation with the elites? Or do you think we're going to end up getting there with them kicking and screaming?
Okay, I'll do that one first.
Yeah.
We did it partly in cooperation with elites before. You know, William Beveridge was in the elite. He went to rugby. Tawney, you know, R.A. Tawney, he went to rugby as well with William. So we did it in cooperation with some of the elites. Attlee was in the elite. You only don't do it in cooperation with the elites when you have a war and you get rid of them. So there are always some elites who are more useful, and there are some who kick and scream against it. Jacob Rees-Mogg is never going to get on side. But I think that's just a message of how it's gone before. The moral outrage you really need is moral outrage about how people are treated at the bottom. And that's what you see in more equal countries. So I once made the mistake of talking to a room like this, except the difference was the room had three babies in it. And it was this time of night, but there were three babies, and it was nice, and you could hear them. And I'd say congratulations to you people in Oslo. You have the lowest rate of child poverty in the world. And people started shouting, it's a scandal. Child poverty in this country is shameful. It's 10%. It's how can you, you know, you ignorant person from England. It was the lowest in the world. But they were still angry about it, which is why it was the lowest in the world. And the same in Finland now. Finland has one of the lowest rates in Europe. And it's a national scandal that it went up slightly. And nobody in Finland goes, look, it's still the lowest. Whereas, you know, in the USA, you try to talk about issues of child poverty and you get back, feckless parents should work harder. And you even get back, you honestly still get, it would be good if they died because the survival of the fittest, and why do you want to look after? So America has rapidly rising infant mortality in Texas. And one of the things you hear is, why would you want to keep those particular babies alive? Because they're only, and that's the nastiest side. So we've learned to live with one in four children in this country growing up in poverty. We've just got used to it. You know, that kind of happens. We don't wake up in the night going, this is happening. And that's the change. And when you begin to change it, you suddenly see more people begin to have views they didn't have before. And also you have outriders who complain about things which everybody thinks is reasonable. Give you one example. When my parents were children, it was absolutely common to beat children. You know, and you were weird if you argued against it. I was at school, quite old at school, when corporal punishment was banned in state schools. You could pay for it, and if you sent your kid to a private school, before it was banned there. What you've got to think about moral sentiment is, what is the thing that currently happens that almost everybody accepts as part of life that will not happen in 40 or 50 years' time? And the people who begin arguing for that now will be the ones that really matter. And it won't be being vegetarian, because that's already, you know, begun. I think that's a really interesting question, and it's there that you know you're kind of on the vanguard of moving. It's not ridiculous political correctness. You are literally trying to spot the thing we do now which will be seen as abhorrent in future.
We're getting to the time we said we'd end, but one, I'm going to take, can we take three last questions? Just to, before that, just share with you, so I said I work in homelessness. We had some colleagues who went to a lovely international conference in Rotterdam last week. In Rotterdam, there is nobody sleeping on the streets because it's not acceptable. Simply not permitted. Anytime anyone is looking like they're going to end up on the streets, it is a crisis and it is fixed. So it's simply, that's a city just 2.5 hours away. The mayor welcomed the whole international delegate to say, this is what we do in Rotterdam. We do not think it is acceptable for anyone to have to sleep on the streets. So we've done away with it. We've fixed it. And it takes a bit of work, but it's not that hard. And it's now what the colleagues who went were very interested that it had become morally, very, very morally shocked at our position in this country as what we tolerated. How do you live in a country which lets that happen? So, question there.
Nearly everything you've said tallies with what I sense. I'm not an economist, but in what I sense and what I read. Something you've not mentioned, I'm not sure how it fits into the paradigm, the sort of paradigm you're presenting, is climate change, which is often the unmentionable amongst economists, which bothers me because it should always be mentioned. And what I sense, or what I think, is, you're describing an economic situation where things are equalising out of, because we're moving to, we're not at catastrophe points, but we're heading in that direction. And then the question, as you described, is, do we go to catastrophe? Do we unfortunately get to catastrophe and war? Or can we reverse it before? Okay. Well, the world I see in front of me is a world where parts of the world are like becoming no man's lands. have become untouchable places. So, for example, the Syrian migration, a lot of people don't really, it was a great instigator behind it,
was
drought.
Yeah.
And so I see a world where you have areas which become blank areas where of desertification and people, okay. Refugee populations migrating. And I'm not sure, I like a lot of what you said, but I'm not sure how we can have a world in the future where you can have more equal societies existing, you know, in separate enclaves, and around those separate enclaves you have abandoned places with millions of people pressing on the borders.
Okay,
to come
okay,
in.
I've got an answer to that. Yeah,
that's a good question
to describe.
There's a hand here, and then there was a hand here. Yeah, so there.
It's been great listening to this here in this room. Wonderful arguments. But who really counts is listening to these arguments? Who are the people who are actually able to make the difference? Or who are the people in the elites that you talk about who are actually listening and hearing and responding to what you're saying?
And the last question from here.
Why don't we abolish prisons and replace them with small therapeutic centres?
Right, okay. I'll do them in order, and I'll keep them short. You said at the beginning I draw maps. With a colleague called Ben Hennig, one of our favourite maps of the world is one in which we draw the world proportion of the population and we shade it by areas that are likely to be uninhabitable because of lack of water. And the kind of good news is that the largest area is Syria to Israel, but that's the largest area, so it's on the predictions, it's not everywhere, it's a small number of places. And human beings, it made a lot of sense 8,000 years ago to be between the Tigris and Euphrates. It was nice and marshy and wet, it ain't anymore. And what you now then need to think about, and it won't be hundreds of millions moving, but people have to move. And it would make sense to have more people moving to places that had already built a sewer system, so you don't have to build a new one. And I'm kind of thinking Glasgow, which has half the population it had 50 years ago, and the same sewers are there.
We take more refugees than...
We put the refugees up.
Yeah.
But I think if you want a more stable world, those rich countries that have actually got this investment they've already put in should have higher populations. When people move from a high fertility country to a low fertility country, they have less children. So the more migrants you're allowed to move, the faster we head towards 8.5 billion rather than 10. You're important, you know, you really, this is honestly how it works. You matter, but also the spads of Theresa May listen and tell her the line about grammar schools will go down well because you're giving a chance to the lower orders. Didn't worry about it before because, you know, essentially if you don't do well enough to earn enough money to send your kid private to be in the 7% or the 20% in London, that was the deal before. So the spads of Theresa May are listening. It's there and working out what they have to do as this issue slowly and steadily rises up the agenda. The biggest issue on the agenda politically for years was immigration. We tried to pretend it wasn't, it's there. Immigration is already falling. You know, one wonderful thing about this terrible vote is you can no longer blame the immigrants. And they suddenly discover it wasn't them. Particularly when 100,000 don't turn up, who haven't turned up in the last year, which is what a third of your midwives in London are. So they are honestly noticing. But the devious ones are thinking, the most devious ones are thinking, how can we make people think they're more equal? Because it's psychological. So as long as they think they're more equal. And in a way, Scandinavia is slightly like this, because Scandinavia has very high wealth inequalities. Mm. It's just that they're low income. I could talk more about, I don't mind high wealth inequalities. I don't mind Richard Branson having his country estate north of my city. I just want the right to roam right across his gardens. but you leave him with his wealth. You may well have found one of the things with prison that will be seen as abhorrent and unbelievable that we did it. We had hardly any prisons 200 years ago. There's a lovely book called A Protestant Purgatory about the history of incarceration and the speed at which it happened. Protestant countries went in for it more. We have still our highest ever prison population now.
Eight times the proportion
that it was. Yeah. That may be seen as the thing that we allow to happen. Where I live, 6 miles north of me is Campsfield House, which is one of the big detention centres, where it turns out half the people that we detain in there actually have a right to live in Britain, but we still lock them up. I think that's one of the ones. But it's also the same boarding schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I would add them. The thing about boarding schools is people always say they were terrible 30 years ago. And as time goes on, I'm getting old now, I'm over 50. It doesn't change, they were always terrible 30 years ago. So I would add boarding schools to prisons. And that's the end of my answers.
Thank you, Danny.